Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 225, Science Faction Organic Chemistry.
That's the chemistry that you can drink. Like, that's the one that won't hurt you. It's organic.
Yeah, it's the one that's super healthy. Yep.
Cold-pressed. Yeah. Cold-pressed chemistry. I know it is the chemistry class that all chemistry undergrads complain about nonstop, and it's fucking annoying as
so,
well.
So, Bill, you and I share an alma mater in Cal, and I remember a lot of my friends who were going through O-Chem at the time, and O-Chem was just one of those classes everybody knew was hard as hell and that a lot of smart people failed. I knew classes that people failed. O-Chem was one of the few that smart people failed. Very, very difficult class taught at the university level. It is basically exactly what it sounds like, organic chemistry, chemistry that's concerned with carbon or living things. Again, this is the actual definition of organic, which I like to bring up a lot. We've kind of cut up the pseudo-definition that's an appeal to the naturalistic fallacy about what an organic thing is, and they've taken off with it and basically made it a brand name. Organic has to do with carbon. That is what it means. It means you are looking at a carbon-based unit. This is looking at all the really advanced chemistry that goes on involving things like carbon, involving the processes within your body. And the reason it's so hard is because you have these incredibly complex processes within your body. Look up something called the Krebs cycle, which is very, very interesting. The first time I saw the Krebs cycle and had it explained to me, I realized, oh my gosh, that just explained how life works. It literally does, because you think to yourself, why do you need oxygen? Why do you need food? Literally, it's this one chemical process called the Krebs cycle that your body goes into involving ATP and oxygen and outputting the CO2. And it is how you get energy out of food and the air around you. And once you understand the Krebs cycle, you understand the basis of biological life.
I've been doing this podcast with you for, what, 221 episodes? 225,
yes, but yeah.
Whatever.
Math was not your strong suit.
But you've mentioned the Krebs cycle several times. This is the first time that I realized it wasn't one of those old-timey bicycles.
Oh, with the one big wheel?
Yeah.
It's that too, yeah.
Do you know how many times I've pulled up next to a hipster, like, nice Krebs cycle, bro? Yeah.
All that kind of stuff, the interaction of organic molecules, how we're able to process things, creation of energy, they're very complex chemical processes, which is why organic chemistry is such a hard topic. It's one that scares off very, very smart people, but it's also really important if you want to get a good understanding of how biological creatures work and how we function and just all the scientific specifics of the chemistry within our body. Very well-paid positions. A lot of these O-Chem guys go off to do lab work right out of undergrad. I saw quite a few of that. One of those few things where you don't need graduate degrees to immediately go in and be an intro-level lab tech, and you can work your way up pretty quickly. Now, organic chemists are essentially all lab guys. There's no field person running out there doing rogue field organic chemistry. It's all pretty much done in the lab, so you better like fluorescent lighting and AC if you
windowless rooms.
Yeah. Very interesting places where organic chemistry is currently going towards, including the integration of inorganic and organic chemistry together, also known as cyborgs. Eventually, we will have things.
That's why she dominates the UFC. She has science.
Yes, that's right. Eventually, we will have these implants that basically interconnect inorganic material to organic material and allow us to have robots in our bodies and hard drives in our brains and those kind of things. It's also important to think that when we talk about living things, the difference between living things and non-living things, we're breaking those barriers down as well. We've talked before about Craig Venter here in San Diego, who has literally printed life. He took the genetic makeups of life, the chemicals that make up life, arranged it in the exact right order, applied electric shock, and that became a living yeast cell. That means that the boundaries between organic and inorganic chemistry are not as hard as we once thought they were, and
where
that at some
God
point
now?
Yeah, it will be a fluid dynamic. So it might even be a class of chemistry that is not recognized in 50 years because that distinction is no longer a real hard and fast distinction.
It's like organic chem could be phrenology. At some point.
Yes.
You just
advance
beyond it.
Yes. And also, not to be confused, the other field of study that I started a long time ago, orgasmic chemistry.
Very few smart people finish that class.
Oh, dude, no, absolutely not. And by the way, let me just say, worst class ever to fuck around with the Bunsen burner.
It's like the one chemistry class, like the captain of the football teams get an A. Yeah, and like, yeah, bro. High five to the teacher.
Yeah, it's just constantly jizzing into beakers. That's it.
I have a beaker fetish, which really aided me in the class.
And speaking of a beaker fetish, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy. With me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damien Mercado. Damien, how you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing great. And Bobby's not lying. He's a huge Muppets fan because of that beaker.
100%. And our scientist for the evening, Bill. Bill, how are you?
I'm doing all right, but my cell phone is struggling. It was hot enough in the car on the way here that it shut down.
Really?
Yeah.
It's like 78 degrees.
I know. I had the windows down, and I was like, you know, little car sauna, but phone couldn't handle it.
And your car's AC is broken, or are you...
No, I just enjoy heat.
I feel like your phone's tapping out too early. I used to work in the desert. It was like literally 120 degrees.
I think it's maybe because I have it on the dashboard. It's like receiving direct radiation.
I think you kind of got a little bitch of a phone. I'm just saying.
It could be. It's the SE. So.
Yeah, okay.
The Apple Eskimo iPhone. It's made of ice. It's 23 words for it.
And if you want to see a phone that won't give out so easily, go ahead and check out our website at www.thesciencefaction.com for all the articles we cover here, as well as some we don't get to. And if you want to tweet us an ungoogleable question, go ahead and tweet us at Faction Science. The boundaries are... The question cannot be easily Googled. It has to be science-based and has to be interesting enough for us to actually tackle and explain fully. We have an ungoogleable question this week. This week's ungoogleable question, if you could eliminate one element from the Earth to make the world a better place, what would it be and how would it improve the world? So you take the periodic table of elements. One of those things gets crossed off. It cannot exist on Earth. What would you do? You pull away one of those, and how would it improve the world?
I got my answer, but I'm going to sub out the periodic table of elements and replace it with the Captain Planet periodic table of elements.
That doesn't work.
And I'm going to get rid of Hart.
God damn it.
That shit's worthless.
First of all, that's just racist because you hate that little Indian kid.
He was South American, and yes, I do hate him.
And Bill.
Okay, so I thought about which elements are attractive to greedy people, but not that useful, or attractive to powerful / greedy people, but not that useful in general. So the obvious one was gold. It's useful somewhat. Because
it is useful. It's a great conductor, so we use it for electronics.
It's a good conductor, and it's both conductive and it doesn't corrode easily, because it doesn't
oxidize.
It doesn't oxidize. So it makes it useful in my research, for example.
Yes.
So
there's also cancer research, by the way, that utilizes, they input gold flecks into tumors and then use that to target the radiation therapies.
Yeah. Should be said that you are an economist. Gold does aid you in your studies.
Well, so that was why I thought maybe we could get rid of it, because, you know, the whole money thing. But so I moved on to plutonium.
Okay.
Because it seems to have far fewer good uses, and the main reason that we use it is for weapons.
Yes. Well, I would caution this. The main use of plutonium right now is nuclear reactors.
But you can also use uranium for that purpose.
Yes. You can use uranium to produce electricity. Uranium would not work in a plutonium plant.
Sure. Yeah, but then you would just make uranium.
Yeah, you'd build a different plant.
Just from my basic research, today, plutonium releases alpha radiation rather than beta radiation. So it's more harmful if it's ingested than the byproducts of uranium. And it's also the longest lasting nuclear waste product.
And it's also one of the most poisonous things to human beings per unit of volume.
Yeah. So that I'm going to go with plutonium. The runner up was going to be copper, and I was going to try to link that to like Bronze Age weapons,
you need copper. We need that for everything. Yeah. Okay, I think you did a great job there, Bill, unlike Damien.
Plutonium,
I will start talking about plutonium because plutonium was on my list too for all the reasons you talked about. However, we do need that for a lot of nuclear power generation. We also use it for space exploration because plutonium is used as the heat source and the power source for essentially all of our far-ranging satellites and space program things, because it slowly gives off heat its entire life. Because of that long half-life you're talking about, that is what we use for our Mars explorers. It's what we use for our satellites. We do still need that here. Still not a bad call to get rid of it, because it would do some good for getting rid of those nuclear weapons. You can also say the same thing about uranium, because you can make a nuclear weapon out of uranium. It's actually much easier to make a nuclear weapon out of uranium. In fact, you and I could do it. We could build a nuclear bomb out of uranium. We could not do that with plutonium. The plutonium-style bomb is way too hard to design. You need very specific engineering. But a uranium bomb, we could build that in my garage. So uranium is also...
You heard that, government. You heard that, FBI.
Yeah. Yeah, they know. They know. So uranium is also up there as one of them. However, uranium, also used in nuclear power. As much as nuclear power has its downsides, right now our biggest downside is basically our greenhouse gas crisis. And if nuclear power was all gone tomorrow, that would accelerate very quickly. And so I am hesitant to take out either uranium or plutonium, though I do think both are good answers. I went in a very different direction after doing a lot of research on this. I went around and I looked at something and I thought, this is a really good candidate, but what if we get rid of it? And I tried to look at all the downsides, and there are. This wouldn't be perfect world if we got rid of this, because it still has uses. I am going to go with something very close to what Bill thought. Not gold, but lead. And here's why. Lead, it has a lot of useful purposes, not least of which is shielding us from the radiation of those two previously mentioned elements. You know, we use lead-lined walls and stuff. However, we do have things that can shield us, as well as lead. Not as cheap, not as easily, but they can do it. We do use lead for things like fishing weights. We do it, but you know what else we use lead for?
Poisoning the children of Flint.
Yes. So we use it for things like bullets. So you, by getting rid of lead, you're going to get rid of a lot of we make bullets out of. But most importantly is the huge issue of lead brain poisoning. It's another one of those things that we don't talk about enough in terms of the damage that it does. We now know that lead inundation from leaded fuels that basically got into the air, the water systems that people were using, caused a huge uptick of violence, birth defects, and huge societal ills from basically 1935 up through the late 70s. We can actually track this on a graph, and it's way worse the closer you are to things like major freeways because they're getting more and more lead exposure. We created entire generations of children who had decreased IQ, but also increased violence and aggression. We have this thing that happened, again, another thing people don't know about. We live in a very safe time, especially here in the United States. Starting in the early 90s, we had a dramatic and unexplained universal drop in violent crime. Huge drop. I mean, you're talking about a steep, steep cliff falling off. And there was a lot of speculation as to why that was. There's a famous theory by the Freakonomics economists that it was because it coincided with legalized abortion in the 1970s. Then people could get the abortion that they wanted, and then they didn't have kids that would grow up to be in prison systems. There was that idea. But another big idea, and this seems to have more and more traction as we go on, is we basically created generations of psychopathic, highly violent individuals by poisoning their brains with lead during the developmental phases of their gestation. And that is very real. We see the effects of lead on the brain of developing kids, and it takes away a lot of their inhibition. It not only lowers their intellect, it increases their violence levels. And we see when we take lead out of a population, dramatic differences in all forms. You're talking about personality context. You're talking about intelligence. You're talking about abilities. You're talking about longevity and lifespan, health impacts while you are alive. All of those things are dramatically affected by lead. If we could remove it completely from the face of the earth, we'd have to figure something out to be our fishing weights. We'd have to figure something out if we wanted bullets. We'd have to figure some stuff out. But I think the vast damage that it's doing is unrecognized. It took us until the 2000s to recognize it in the United States. Think what lead is doing in Tanzania. Think what it's doing in third world countries. If we could get rid of it on the face of this earth right now, we would have such a huge increase in general IQ, in general health, huge drop in violent levels just by eliminating this one element off the earth.
Another couple of crucial things that lead is used for, I'm not saying this makes it, you know, a bad thing to get rid of, but
awesome heavy cups.
There you go. Solder.
Yes.
So the electronics that we use every day would be a little more difficult.
It's mostly a mixture of lead and tin, and you could just do a tin heavy thing.
It would be more difficult. Yes. You know, we could get around it with engineering because we're smart animals.
A gold solder.
And we'd be much smarter because we wouldn't have so much lead poisoning.
Maybe. There's also, it's a crucial element in PZT, lead zirconate titanate, which is a piezoelectric, which is also in many of the electronics we use. There are other piezoelectrics that work.
Quartz is a piezoelectric.
Yeah, right. I mean, but it doesn't work quite as well.
Also, come on, how many piezoelectric generators? You got a few people walking around with quartz watches. That's about it.
Well, my research, actually, this is why I know about this, is based on piezoelectric vibration.
Okay.
And we use it to create mists of fluids. It's also used for many, many other things, like micro rotors. So, like, instead of having an engine to turn your rotor, you have like a little piece of this piezoelectric, and that's what causes the drive of the rotor.
But you've admitted there's other ones, right? So we could go quartz.
There are other piezoelectrics, so it's...
And if we had a general increase of 5 to 10 IQ points across the world and lowered violence, it's probably worth it.
We come up with something else, yeah.
So anyway, my answer to that, of course, is lead. Guys, please go ahead and tweet us your ungoogleable questions at Faction Science. But for now, let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
All right, article number one. There are way more gorillas and chimps than we thought. Awesome news. This has to do with an ecological study in Central Africa.
Charlton Heston's worst nightmare is this study. This is
one of those gorillas pried a gun from his cold dead hands.
Dirty apes. To call them dirty apes, that's what they are.
This was a massive ecological study, boots on the ground type of thing. And we found out that the numbers we had were wrong. In fact, we found there's about 110% as many chimps as we thought, so a 10% increase, and 130% of Western lowland gorillas, a 30% increase. Those are both significant. Those are both great. I'm so happy that it's on the positive side of the ledger as opposed to the negative. Great news.
Is that so when they asked, like, hey, can all the chimps raise their hand, there was a significant number who didn't, and gorillas were more cooperative.
That's
right.
We see an increase in our estimations of both of the populations of both of those animals. That's fantastic. However, most of them, 80%, still live outside of protected ranges, which means who knows how long they will be there. And something to consider, which is of the great apes, the two that they looked at, of the six species of great apes, not including Homo sapien, the two that they looked at are actually the most common. So they looked at the chimp, not the bonobo. Chimp is common. They think the chimp population is about 130,000. That's pretty big, not huge.
Planet-wide?
Yeah, but they only live in one part of Africa, so it's not, you know, it's not that big a deal. So the chimps, about 130,000. The lowland gorillas, 360,000 or so. Now, that's great that we have more than we thought. That's fantastic. Neither of those animals are too plentiful that we should start hunting them or anything. That's fantastic. However, when you look at subpopulations like the bonobo, which has much smaller population, much more restricted geographic area.
Which is ironic because they just fuck all the time.
They do
right?
fuck all the time, right, yeah.
Yeah, but they do a lot of same-sex fucking. Yeah. Like it's a lot of wasted semen.
For pleasure.
Yeah. And both species of orangutans. But the most endangered is, of course, the highland gorilla. So the lowland gorilla, there's 360-some-odd thousand we now know. The highland gorilla, we think there's about 600 individuals.
Is that because it's
probably
harder to
less, very hard to find them.
Is that because it's harder to breathe at those high altitudes?
No, it's because they get murdered constantly. They live in one spot, and they basically have been murdered through many, many civil wars in that area. And
for bushmeat?
For bushmeat. One of them is they got murdered because they were in a protected area, like a ranger protected area, and this rebel group wanted to show the government that they did not respect their protected area, so they slaughtered all the gorillas. And then they left them staked out for them to find. There are very few of these left. These are the big guys that you see at the zoo. These are the big giant ones, the big silverbacks. Those are the big highland gorillas.
Hello, Jane Goodall here.
Oh, God damn it. You must be excited, Jane, because the chimps, the one you studied, we found out there were more of them than we previously thought.
Oh, I was the one saying there's tons more. I find that mainstream scientists are great at dismissing Jane Goodall.
That's
true. They're terrible at counting primates. Okay. You've wildly underestimated the amount of Sasquatch in North America alone. Can't get a good chimp count.
If you want to wonder why we were wrong before, we were doing estimates in places that are very violent. It's hard to get boots on the ground. This is the first time we've been able to do a big, thorough, detailed study all at the same time. Because remember, one of the other hard parts is you do a detailed study into the part that's politically safe, and then you estimate the other part. Well, those populations can move. So unless you kind of do the entire survey at once, you're guessing as to, did I double count that one? Have I not counted this?
Isn't it very hard to get boots on the ground simply because you're drawing from scientists? If you wanted to get therapeutic loafers on the ground, you could very easily do that.
Just so you know,
or New Balance.
Field scientists, we take a lot of pride in our boots, the thing we spend the most money on.
You don't speak for all field scientists.
Yes, I do. You can
as
buy
a coolologist, a field coolologist.
You can buy cheap clothes, but you spend good money on boots. In terms of biological population estimates in general, you got to remember we are better at some animals than others. These have some pluses and downsides. The pluses are it's easier to see things that are larger. So big animals like these, you count them more accurately. The downsides are the location they're at, not only political unrest, but deep, dark, thick jungles. You can't just do a satellite overhead shot like you can with bison.
I imagine if you're counting the highland gorilla, you could get killed by a gorilla.
Yes. Oh, 100%.
Right? Like,
yeah.
You just rip your head off.
Well, I mean, yeah, you could, Bill.
Yeah. Damien speaks sign language, so they won't mess with
me. I know Coco.
while this is good news, hopefully we can find a way to protect those really endangered populations like the bonobo, like the some of the orangs, like the highland gorilla, and hopefully we'll keep those things alive because it would be nice for them to live on for a few more generations. On to article number two. The interesting answer to the shovel-shaped incisor question. Guys, this is one of the most interesting articles we have covered in weeks. I love this article. It explains a mystery many of you probably didn't even know we were trying to figure the answer out to.
Yeah, I mean, that's usually the greatest mystery, is the one that nobody cares about.
Yeah, like, exactly. So there is something called a shovel-shaped incisor. Any of you who have taken anatomy or biological anthropology knows it's one of the first ways that we can tell the difference in different groups of people. So a shovel-shaped incisor, the incisor is the front teeth. So just think of the very front ones in your mouth, four on the top, four on the bottom. Those are your incisors. Now, if you are a person of African or European or most of Asian descent, your incisor kind of is like a flathead screwdriver. However, there is something called a shovel-shaped incisor, which is ubiquitous among all of the natives of North and South America, meaning before contact, 100% of them had shovel-shaped incisors, as well as some people from Northeastern Asia. This is a shape that's a little bit more like, almost like a U shape, that very specific shape. And picturing the tooth isn't as important as knowing that the fact that that very particular shape is, again, 100% in all native groups of North and South America, a little bit in those other people, and essentially non-existent in most Europeans and African populations. Very interesting because it allowed us for a long time to easily distinguish skeletons. You find a skeleton, oh, is this an Indian burial ground or a murder site? Well, let's check the incisors. Boom. So we have known this for a long time. What we didn't know is why. Now, in situations of evolutionary biology, whenever you see a trait that is ubiquitous, meaning it's completely contained, the entire population has it, so an entire population of two continents had this particular trait, that usually means it has a very strong selective advantage. But what would be the selective advantage of these teeth? There were ideas for decades. Oh, it adds structural stability, so these people who were hunter-gatherers could gnaw on bones. It prevents certain types of cavities from high-protein diets. There was a lot of far-out-there ideas, but nobody could tell for sure what it was that was causing this. We just knew it had to have some kind of selective advantage. A new study was published this week that has solved the mystery.
Perhaps it helped in the digestion of one of their staple foods.
Squash!
Corn. Damn it, I was about to say corn!
So, what do we know about these natives? Well, it turns out we do know that, as we've talked about before on this show, the group that became North and South American Native Americans were actually all isolated in a place called Beringia, a continent that is now underwater in between Alaska and Russia. They were isolated there for many thousands of years. You had this population that moved up into that area, stayed there, were kept out of coming into North America by ice sheets and other stuff, and they basically stayed in this isolation for a long period of time before they eventually made their way down into the Americas as Beringia was slowly flooded. Well, while they were up there, they were at a very high latitude, meaning they were super far up north in that Beringial area, especially during an ice age type of conditions. You're not getting very much sunlight. What does that mean? It means that their children will have a very hard time getting enough fat to survive and also producing enough vitamin D. Both of those they get from breast milk from their mom, and there was a huge selection pressure on those babies to get the most vitamin D and the most fat they could at that latitude. Well, what we found is there's a gene that causes an increase in the density and the number of ducts, of milk-carrying ducts within the breast, and basically allows more vitamin D, more milk, and more fat to be breastfed to infants. That particular gene just happens to coincide with the shovel-shaped incisors. And so they were right, it was being selected for, but it had nothing to do with the teeth itself. It was being selected for a breast that produced more milk with more vitamin D, and it just happened as a byproduct to produce shovel-shaped incisors. That is an incredibly interesting mystery solved by science this very week.
So Eskimo breast milk is very fatty? And
yes, actually, it would
and
be
full
it would,
of energy.
Yes, it would be. And they've just kept this throughout their radiation as they, you know, came down into North America, South America. They kept this trait because it was so ubiquitous among the Beringial founding population. So
does this gene it changes the rate at which milk is?
It increases. Think of it as making not only bigger but more tunnels coming from the milk gland to the nipple, so you can put out more milk. Fattier milk with more vitamin D in it.
So fattier would make it more viscous, so you would need a larger
exactly.
an exit point?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So yeah, this.
And then what about the vitamin D part?
Allows more of the milk consumption and the fattier milk, which has more vitamin D in it.
Oh, I see. Okay, so like vitamin D is like fat soluble or something.
Well, not
like
just that, but you're getting more of the total amount of it.
Okay.
Is there any disadvantage to having shovel teeth?
We don't know.
I mean, like, are you more prone to cavities?
Oh, I don't know that any of that has been done. We have not been able to find any advantage strictly on the base of it, so I don't think they would have found a disadvantage yet either.
Would a rake or perhaps hoe-shaped teeth be better? It's a long way to go for a hoe joke.
This is a long way to go for a hoe joke. Very interesting stuff. I think it's one of those, every time we solve a mystery like that, it's like, oh my God, why didn't we think about that? It was a byproduct this whole time. We thought it might have been a direct selection. It was an indirect selection. Also, it's just great to understand why things are the way they are, especially when it's an interesting story like this.
You've talked before about how there is a racial bias with science. Like, we discover a lot of shit with white people.
Yeah.
And then...
Not as much.
Yeah, so the point is, if we had shovel teeth, then we'd have gotten to the bottom of this mystery.
Oh, we would have known a long time ago. There's a reason we figured out cystic fibrosis a long time ago. All right, let's move right on to everybody's favorite game. I call BS.
I call.
I call.
I call.
I call.
I call.
Ring, ring.
I call BS.
All right, I call BS is the game where I read four science news articles, and my panelists compete to see which ones are real and which ones are BS. Damien, are you ready to lose?
Yes, I'm ready to lose. We're going to try some reverse psychology here, Bill. Yeah, I'm ready. I love this game. It, you know, when you say everybody, I think you might be just referring to me because...
No, it's literally everybody, including you.
Oh,
you know
so,
what?
So it's something we all
especially you.
Not just the biggest fans. It's for everyone.
This is like the Game of Thrones of podcast segments. Everybody's down.
Absolutely. All right. Article number one. A young child in China was taken to the hospital after having irritated skin on her arm, and to the horror of the doctors, they discovered a rubber band embedded within the tissue of her arm. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science. You said it was a female child. Those don't exist in China. All boys.
We import the other ones from Philippines. All right, and Bill.
Okay, so I'm going to say that this is bad science. It wasn't a rubber band. It was... paperclip. Okay. It's a paperclip.
We just file this kid away with it here.
Yeah,
this
so she was trying to brand herself.
Oh, I gotcha.
She was joining a street gang.
Gotcha.
And it just got embedded in there.
Wow, the detail. This was a Chinese kid.
I like the idea of branding yourself with a paperclip to join a street gang. Like, it's a gang started by that spell check paperclip from Microsoft Word a few years back.
Clip me, help me be popular amongst my peers.
It looks like you're trying to write a resume, motherfucker. Article number two. Researchers have found that newspaper op-ed pieces are almost completely pointless as they appear to change almost no one's opinions and have no long-lasting effects. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science. Our current president proves this is bad science. There's one network that's just all editorials.
All right, and Bill.
I will go with science just based on the idea that people who read op-ed articles are generally just reinforcing the views they already hold.
You seek out knowledge you already want to know.
Right.
Okay. Article number three. Researchers have recently developed an infinitely recyclable plastic. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is science, but it's also old news. I don't know if you guys know this, but you can reuse your condom. Like, I bought one, and that's all
it's
I've used.
It's not even plastic, Damien.
Yeah, you can rinse it out if you want. Oh, okay.
And Bill.
You said infinitely recyclable?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go with bad science because I find it hard to believe that they've gone that far.
Is this like a David Foster Wallace, like a sequel book,
Infinite
Recycle?
Infinite Recycle, yeah. This one has more teenage tennis writing, though, so.
Deep joke. It's a science joke. Prove us wrong that you're a smart listenership.
Article number four. Neuroscientists recently discovered the process of how the human brain dies, only to find out that the exact process was described in an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation from 1988. Damien, is this science or bad science?
It's when you take off the visor.
When you take off Geordi's visor?
Yeah, when you take off Geordi's, the optical nerves die, so this is science.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to say this is bad science only because it's not science. It is cultural hysteriography, or however you pronounce that word.
Trying to split the difference, eh, Bill? All right, let's go back and see how you guys did following at home and see how you did. Article number one. A young child in China was taken to the hospital after having irritated skin on her arm, and to the horror of the doctors, they discovered a rubber band embedded within the tissue of her arm. Both of you guys thought this one was false, and this one is science. It turns out that in Chinese culture, it's common to put colored rubber bands on the arms of children for good luck. Well, the rubber band made its way into like the little fat folds that babies have, and then the skin grew over it, and it became embedded within the actual tissue itself. And then it just had this weird scar tissue of this band around the arm, and the grandparents took her to the doctor, and they're like, what? And like just started pulling a rubber band out, like that magic trick with scarves in the sleeve, like just started pulling a rubber band out.
And they never once, I don't know, bathed the baby anything?
Wouldn't that have cut off circulation to the hand?
No, because I guess it just got down into the folds without being
but
tight
I
enough.
That this child has grown over that time,
yes,
right?
Yes, and it grew around it. Like, you know when you wrap barbed wire around a tree and then the tree grows around the barbed wire? That's what happened to this poor kid. Also, maybe they're not so lucky. Like, maybe the rubber bands aren't lucky if they cause this.
Yeah, definitely not.
It's actually the safest toy a Chinese parent can give
yes.
a child.
It was either that or the bag of broken glass and hypodermic needles. That's also known as a Chinese Lincoln Log set. All right, on to article number 2. Researchers have found that newspaper op-ed pieces are almost completely pointless as they appear to change almost no one's opinions and have no long-lasting effects. Damien thinks this is false. Bill thinks this is true. And this one is bad science. It's the opposite. They found to have undue influence. Through 2 randomized experiments, researchers found that op-ed pieces had large and long-lasting effects on people's views among both the general public and policy experts. The study also found that Democrats and Republicans altered their views in the direction of the op-ed piece in roughly equal measure. One of the ideas is we're so used to being bombarded with a whole bunch of different opinions on things like Facebook, but some of us, especially if you're in an older generation, do give some kind of, whether it's conscious or not, inherited weight to things like op-ed pieces because we grew up with them in the newspaper and they had some form of validity to them. The other is that a lot of times these people are presenting their ideas charismatically. Anybody can start a blog. You have to actually be able to do an opinion that's entertaining and charismatic to be an op-ed writer. Because of that, a lot of times people can relate to them better. And since a lot of times this comes from people who are kind of like you, they're not necessarily the professional writers, you might be more likely to sympathize with them, even if they hold views that are different than the ones you originally had. Interestingly, these op-ed pieces seem to do more to change people's minds than actual factual scientific information and studies.
This sounds a lot like that piece where the quality of the sound was a big indicator of whether
yes.
someone would agree with the scientific study that was being presented.
Right. If they did a really high-quality podcast, and they have great sound, they would like it, and then it could be fucking Stephen Hawking, but if it's bad audio, and it would be because it's Stephen Hawking,
right.
you know, then they're not going to like it as much. Yeah, very true. It's one of those things to think about, and always good to be aware of your own biases. We have an inherent bias towards us. You should know about it.
It makes sense. I mean, Andrew Wakefield's a very charismatic
That's
man.
That's true. He's great at the op-ed on the New York Times.
Treasure, like Harry Connick Jr.
Article number 3. Researchers have recently developed an infinitely recyclable plastic. Damien thinks this is true. Bill thinks this is false. And this one is science and very interesting. Some plastics can be recycled and some cannot. So PET, which is a common variant, can be because it has weak chemical bonds. Some plastics with really strong chemical bonds, they're either near impossible to do or it's so hard that the energy involved, you might as well just make some new plastic, right? The new plastics that they're coming with have not only super weak chemical bonds, but essentially bonds that are able to be dissolved with so little energy that they reform every time you heat them up or you zap them with enough electricity or you do whatever you're going to do to them. So you can take this thing that is a solid piece and turn it into a liquid over and over again the same way you can with water and ice. There's essentially no limit. It's like saying, how many times can I make this water ice? Well, you can do it infinitely as long as you're putting away or taking away energy from the system. The same is true of this plastic. The molecules themselves don't degrade in the heat, so it's never going to be any different than it originally was. It's constantly recyclable because it constantly goes back to that same base unit that you can rearrange in all these different functions. You can make it into thin sheets. You can make it into thick, hard objects. But regardless, when you're done, you just melt it back down. I love these types of technologies because, mark my words, I think this is what's coming in the future. Everybody's going to have a 3D printer. And the material that it prints with, the liquid that it turns into solid that it prints with, is going to be a plastic like this. In addition, everything you buy in the store, the wrapping for it, is going to be made out of this type of plastic. So you buy that package of Oreos, you open it up, you eat the Oreos, then you take the wrapping, both the tray that holds the Oreos and the plastic wrapper around it, you toss it in your little kiln machine, it melts it down, and that becomes your printer ink. And the idea being you essentially eliminate the waste products of packaging. You won't be able to do it for everything, but you will be able to do it for a lot so that all of a sudden, instead of waste that's cumbersome that you have to get rid of, you've actually gotten a commodity, which is the printer ink that you're going to use for your 3D printer.
So doesn't plastic and trash would have an inherent value. You could have a trash economy.
Yes.
I'm rich in trash.
Yes, the same way we do with recyclables now. Think about it that way. We make aluminum recyclable. It gives it an inherent value. Now you don't see aluminum cans on the street because homeless people will go pick them up.
Yeah, so basically now it'd be fighting. If I see a homeless guy picking bottles out of my trash, I go up and fight him. He's robbing me of my future.
I assume that these plastics as they are now are not very strong.
Sort of. So what's interesting is the strength of these type of plastics have to do more with the physical shape that you put them in than the chemical structure. So because of that, you can make fairly tough objects out of this stuff, but you can also make flexible, bendy plastics as well. Okay. So very interesting stuff. That might be the future. You know, you have a little kiln in your house. You melt down all your trash when you get it in. That becomes the stuff you use to build all the stuff that you want. So it would be a constant recycling and much better than creating the Pacific trash heap that we currently have bigger than the size of Texas floating around in the ocean. Hopefully, you get enough incentive. And now, again, those type of plastics, this probably wouldn't apply to. But if you could get to a point where you get enough incentive to just to get raw plastic material, people maybe go out and they clean those things because there's some fiscal benefit to them in the end. All right, and lastly, article number 4. Neuroscientists recently discovered the process of how the human brain dies, only to find out that the exact process was described in an episode of The Next Generation from the late 80s. Damien thinks this is true. Bill thinks this is false. And this one is science. And it was the death of Tasha Yar, as we all remember. Sad day for every young nerd.
I mean, I was like, what, 4 or 5 at that point? I don't think I'd come out as a nerd yet at that point.
Sad day. So basically, in that episode, Dr. Crusher notes that there's still hope to revitalize Lieutenant Yar, even though there's technically no brain activity. And she says, neurons are beginning to depolarize as the first process, and then she will eventually die. This process was recently just observed in humans. When the researchers went back, they stumbled across this. Now, it doesn't mean that the Next Generation guys were just so on the ball. They predicted scientific knowledge 30 years ahead of time. In fact, they had just looked at animal experiments, which had showed the same thing since the 1960s. It's basically looking at the process of brain death from an animal model versus a human model, and they extrapolated it was probably the same, wrote that into the Next Generation, technically predating the scientific literature by 30 years.
It's crazy that a sci-fi show from 88 had more research done in the writing than almost every movie coming out today.
Than our current president's cabinet who advises on scientific matters.
I figured they were just like putting science-y words together, like, you know, like flux capacitor or whatever. But they actually knew what they were talking about.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And clearly had done some back research into the way animal
just
brain
just another
happened.
Reason for nerds to prefer Star Trek over Star Wars.
Yes, absolutely. Exactly. 100%. Well, that, and I mean...
Worf is badass.
Yeah. You give Worf a batleth, put him against Chewie, and you're going to have one dead bear. That's all I got
to
say.
Though I don't think I've ever seen Worf win a fight on an episode of Star Trek. He's just there. He's just there as a tough guy who then gets his ass kicked. He's like the gatekeeper for the champion.
Fair enough, but the whole point is that he's such an imposing figure. You know what? Never mind. I don't want to get in here defending Worf. It says
this is a science podcast.
Worf is a self-contained unit. I don't need to defend him. Anyway, congrats, Damien, for slowly eking by what was considered a pathetic and miserable victory that you'll undoubtedly gloat about for years to come. As I think it's literally the only win in recent memory.
Our fans, I don't know if you know this, but he's probably going to edit it out. But he actually punched the wall midway through congratulating me.
Yes.
Creating hours of work repairing that in his own home.
Absolutely. 100%. Anything. Just boiling over with anger. Just thinking about how long you're going to talk about this. I mean, last time you won a game.
The champion.
Last time you won a game was 4 or 5 years ago. And you still bring it up as if it happened recently.
It was a
recently.
Game of war? Yeah. Card game?
No, I do bring it up to remind you that I have had victories.
See, he's doing
within
it again.
This month.
He's doing it again. He's doing it again.
And that you're rewriting of history.
How dare you. All right. Well, thank you, audience, for coming back for Science Faction 255, where you learned about organic chemistry, how there are way more chimps and gorillas than we thought, the interesting answer to the shovel-shaped incisor question, why a young child in China had a rubber band embedded within her arm, why op-ed pieces have undue influence, how researchers recently developed an infinitely recyclable plastic, and how Star Trek The Next Generation predicted research that wouldn't be published for 30 years. Thank you so much for listening. Come on back next week for Science Faction 226.
Jane Goodall here. You know, the natives of North America would have been much better off had they not had shovel-shaped teeth. If instead, they had a Sasquatch-shaped dick.
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.